every strata of our society, of our lives we live, from our kids at school to what we do at home to driving, everything is going to change. And that is just too much change for human brains to handle. Like, I'm a tech optimist. I love AI. I love technology. And I think we are going to get to some kind of utopia at some stage. But the road between here and there is going to be pretty bumpy, pretty painful, pretty horrific for a lot of people, right? And so what we need to do, humans, is to focus the North Star of the quality of our lives. How can we maintain the best quality of our lives over the next 15, 20 years? And to do that, we have to shift the conversation to people, to how we're going to live, how we're going to cope and manage through all this change.
Joel Pearson, thank you for being back on Uncomfortable Conversations. This is a very relevant week to be talking to someone who is an expert in artificial intelligence, because all I've seen and all I've heard on my WhatsApp threads and on podcasts is chatter about Matt's piece, which went viral, which is about AI. So if people don't know, Matt Schumer, who's an AI person in Silicon Valley, wrote a piece that went viral about trying to communicate to the normies how, like, the scale and the scope of what's about to come and the changes that society is about to undergo as a result of artificial intelligence. And that this, I feel like this conversation has now broken the banks from being one that tech nerds talk about to one that everybody who has sort of just been AI curious but not AI informed is now talking about. If you haven't read Matt's article, I'll just quote a little bit from it. He says, "The people I care about deserve to hear what's coming, even if it sounds crazy." He says, "On February 5th, two major AI labs released new models on the same day, GPT 5.3 Codex from OpenAI and Opus 4.6 from Anthropic, who make Claude, one of the main competitors to ChatGPT." And he writes, "And something clicked. Not like a light switch, more like the moment you realize the water has been rising around you and is now at your chest. The experience that tech workers have had over the past year of watching AI go from helpful tool to it does my job better than I do is the experience that everyone else is about to have. Law, finance, medicine, accounting, consulting, writing, design, analysis, customer service. Not in 10 years. The people building these systems say 1 to 5 years. Some say less. And given what I've seen in just the last couple of months, I think less is more likely." And he addresses the reservations that people who've just dabbled in AI occasionally have, which is like, "I tried AI and it wasn't very good. It couldn't even do arithmetic." He says, "In 2022, AI couldn't do basic arithmetic reliably. It would confidently tell you that 7 times 8 equals 54. The next year, it could pass the bar exam. The next year, 2024, it could write working software and explain graduate level science. By late 2025, some of the best engineers in the world said they'd handed over most of their coding work to AI. And on February 5th, this year, so this month, new models arrived that made everything before them feel like a different era. If you haven't tried AI in the last few months, what exists today would be unrecognizable to you. So, who better to tell me how we should prepare for the coming AI apocalypse than Joel Pearson, neuroscientist, head of the Future Minds Lab at UNSW, and second in command of the Human Readiness. Of human readiness, right? Is that
human
right?
At
UNSW. The UNSW AI Institute. Yeah. So one of the leading people in Australia in advising corporations and government on what we should be preparing for and how we should deal with the social and cultural fallout from what's coming with AI. Take it away for the next 2 hours. I've done my work here. I've said enough words. I'm shutting up now. Go.
So thanks for having me back, Josh. Always fun to be here. Yeah, so it is, I mean, I think the canary in the coal mine piece, part of his piece, is the most interesting for me, that, look, this is already happening for those people that do developing, they do programming, they do software stuff. They're already handing over all the technical side of their job to AI. And when I say AI, but I really mean AI agents. So we're all used to, you know, typing into ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini and having a response come back, you know, in 10 seconds or something. But we're kind of past that now. We're in this agentic sort of era, which means they're agents, which means they can go off and act by themselves. So I might give it, you know, a whole lot of long instructions and I can shut it down, turn my computer off, go for a walk, do something else, and it'll keep working on this project in the background, whether it's building a piece of software, building a website, writing a thing, researching the depths of some scientific thing like I do. And when I come back, it's all ready for me. And that's a different way to think about it. It's more like a, you know, a research assistant or a human assistant would do, where they're not going to stand there in front of me and do the work while I'm staring at them.
Right. And like previous iterations of AI, it felt like the research assistant would just keep asking you silly questions throughout the process, right? Which a human wouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, you would tell it to do one step and it would do that. But if you told it to do something complicated, it would get tangled up. And yeah. Now it doesn't.
And it would need you to be there the whole time giving it feedback. Now they can go off. I think Claude's new model, the 4.6 one, I think it did a task for 2 weeks straight without human intervention. And these are programming large, heavy, dense pieces of software with hundreds of thousands of lines of code. And
I mean, imagine how much thinking it's doing in 2 weeks, given that its brain operates.
That was about a
tens of thousands of times
token
faster.
Cost, I think, USD.
Right, right.
So it costs, you know, but the comparison would be hundreds of thousands of dollars in human fees to do that over 6 months plus.
Mm.
So that's the comparison. And if you're doing software, now these agents not only will make it, they'll go off and test it like a human. So they can put it in a sandbox thing or in a browser and go on, press all the buttons and test it. So it goes through iterations. If it finds a bug, it'll fix that. And it can do all that before it even gets to you.
Mm.
So that's
And just to clarify this practically, like so that people understand, you know, what we're talking about. At the moment, this is mostly in the space of coding because that's where they're starting to roll out the most sophisticated AI, which means in practice, like if a layperson has access to this, I don't know if they've rolled out the coding software to everyone.
Yeah, they do. Yep.
Okay, so I want to create an app that tells me what the fastest way to use public transportation is to get from my house to anywhere that I want to enter because the New South Wales public transit app is no good, let's say. I don't need to know anything.
Correct.
I can just go to it and say,
describe what you want.
What I want to do is I want to create this app and, you know, I want it to be tailor-made to my house. And when you open it up, I want it to look a little bit, I want it to look colorful and playful, you know, and I want it to, and then it will build the app, use the app, see what problems there are with the app and what mistakes it's made, fix the problems, and then come back and say,
yeah,
how do you like this for an app?
And it will go further. It'll go into the business model if you want to, you know, where to host it or how to host it or any problem you have, it'll solve it for you. And you can set it to check with you every time if you're worried about it going off and doing its own thing, or you can set it to don't bother me and just go and finish the thing. And so this is now, so Claude has the Claude Code and they have the Claude Cowork, which is kind of a version of this to run sort of on your desktop. So not so much for programming, but for using other apps. And, you know, and now it has plugins for Excel and PowerPoint. And so this is the other thing we're seeing. It's not just the brute power of an intelligence of the model. It's the plugins to other pieces of software that people use every day in their work. So it's becoming more and more integrated to all the tools we use. So it is sort of, it's a turning point in what is capable. And I think this year we're going to see a lot of change that we didn't see last year in terms of, yeah, the job market, that this consolidation, the number of humans needed for certain outcomes is just going to shrink. And when, by the end of the year, we're going to see, you know, less hiring, jobs disappearing, and we will start to see unemployment numbers go up.
Right. What are the industries do you think that it's most obviously suited to? I mean, software, engineering.
Anything is digitized at the moment. So anything online. So music. So the other big thing that happened this week was a new Chinese model that released this viral video of Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt fighting. Did you see this?
No.
And it had their voices. It looked, you know, it looked perfect almost. I mean, there's a couple of weird things where the t-shirt went to a long sleeve to a jacket in different shots, but it didn't look like in the past where you're like, yeah, this is AI done. It looked like something that had been shot and they spent a lot of money on. And then some of the studios are now pushing back on the Chinese companies because they're obviously breaching copyright to use these images and voices and things like that.
Right. But I don't think there's going to be a significant change to the employment of actors in the next year as a result of AI. No one's going
to
want,
like,
funny video that I saw. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a guy giving prompts to AI actors to recreate the scene from When Harry Met Sally, the orgasm scene in the diner. And he keeps iterating it with these, because they're perfect. They look perfect, except for, as you say, there are weird things like, you know, she was wearing two brooches instead of one brooch, or like she has, you know, five fingers or something like that. I mean, six fingers or something like that, like just randomly. But the performance when he's trying to coach the AI that this is an ecstatic, orgasmic, you know, experience after the AI has watched Meg Ryan do it, is like the AI actress is like slapping the table and screaming like a little five-year-old girl. Then all of a sudden there's a plate full of forks. You know, there's just, it's like, and the amount of intuition, the amount of human intuition that is still required to pull off a woman faking an orgasm in public is enough that it's quite funny to see the machine try to do it. Like, that is obviously not low-hanging fruit the way that coding a public transport software is, or even, I don't know, reviewing a contract for the purchase of a house, or...
I don't think programming a whole piece of software or an app from scratch, you know, to do anything is low-hanging fruit, right? It was just the strategy of these companies because they want to build their AI to do coding first so they can use it, so they can have this loop of the AI building its next iteration so they can step backwards and backwards and speed up this feedback loop.
So the reason why it's good everyone's at software priority is not because it's naturally good at software. It's because if they made it good at software, then it would be able to build better versions of itself.
Yeah, and that was their priority because they knew that could speed up their progress.
You see what I mean? It's still ones and zeros in software, whereas acting is something...
Yeah, you need to have more world models, more personality. You have to have more levels.
There's something ineffable about art that does not exist when you're creating numbers.
But there are certain Hollywood studios that are already rendering and doing 3D scans of actors. They're doing deals with the actors to use their likeness and their voice for certain things. There are, you know, actors agencies which are now have, you know, a lot of digital actors, completely AI generated actors on their books. So what is happening? When we get, you know, I don't know if it'll be this year or next year, but it's.
I mean,
it's
someone will make one, but I think, in fact, there was just one release, wasn't there? Didn't Netflix do? Did Guillermo del Toro did it or someone? No, he did Frankenstein. There was some other. No, I think it's a mini-series about the... Jono, can you look this up? There's a mini-series about the American Revolutionary War or something, which is entirely AI-generated, and it's an experiment by one of those... I can't remember if it was like...
I mean, there are lots, right? There's
like
fan art on Star Wars, which is... It looks like a whole new film, and it looks really, really good, and it's all AI-generated. You can find lots on there. And some... unknown, but high percentage of everything you see on social media platforms now, all the videos are AI generated. And for a lot of those, you can't tell at all. They look real. And sometimes you'll see something in the background. You're like, oh, this person just morphed away or something. You're like, oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I did not know.
Not to mention the fact that a lot of the comments and tweets themselves are just nonsense slop from bots. But I mean, if you watch a movie and you look at the end credits and you see that, you know, you sit through 8 minutes of credits and there are like hundreds of people who worked on that film. If I were the actor, if I were Brad Pitt, I'd be less worried than like a lot of those people in that list who are working.
All the camera people, the catering,
there's all these layers. And all of the non-physical world things. I mean, all of those jobs that exist digitally, they're either effects or they're, you know, something. The toning of the color on the way that it looks, even the editing of the film or whatever it might be. What is it, Jono? Oh, Darren Aronofsky has done a mini series. So, you know, it's not his finest work. I would say start with Black Swan and then maybe Requiem for a Dream. But
start with Requiem.
Yeah. If you want to slit your wrists by the end of the night. It's not a sunny movie. Yes, I remembered loving it, and then I watched Requiem for a Dream again, couple of years ago. And but about halfway through, I was like, gee, what kind of a screwed up teenager was I? I thought this film was fabulous. Like, it's brilliant, likewise. But man. I take your point. But can we go start where people are going to start seeing it? Because I don't think people are going to wake up one morning and go, my God, there's nothing on at the movie theater apart from AI movies.
Just with films we're talking? Or
no, everywhere. Like, people,
we're going to see, like, so we're already seeing a lot of companies like Amazon and other US big tech companies, like, getting rid of people. So we are going to see, which is the mission of some of these AI companies like OpenAI, is to replace humans in the world, the economy of work, right? To replace humans with AIs. So that's kind of the mission of some of these companies. And we're starting to see that. We're going to see that more and more. And there's going to be this consolidation. It seems to be hitting the graduate sort of entry level junior workforce at the moment. So you can see the unemployment numbers already going up for that graduate entry level in the US. And I think they're going to keep going up this year. So people in Australia, people have lost their jobs, right? So customer service operators that used to answer phones are being replaced now. I don't know if you've had the experience of ringing up a restaurant or anything where, and you're talking to someone and you kind of go, huh, excuse me, are you an AI? And I go, actually, yes, I am.
No, I haven't had that.
I've had that
yet.
Experience really? A few times now. Wow. And I'm like, whoa. And it wasn't until I've been chatting for a while that I thought, this just seems too smooth.
Yeah, right. The service is too good to be human.
But that, yeah. So we're going to see more of that. We're going to see, and I mean,
let me just pause for a second. Sucks for the person in the Philippines who might otherwise have been in a call center, if you're talking about a big corporation, like not just calling a restaurant or something. But I would love to not have to wait on hold to an airline for 45 minutes before talking to someone competent who
yes.
can.
No, I mean,
explain to me why I can't reselect my seat, you know, online.
It will, most of the cases, it will make the customer service experience better and smoother and faster.
Yeah, right.
Right. And it effectively over time will reduce the cost of things as well. But, and we'll see the productivity of a lot of companies go way up. But what happens to the humans doing these jobs? And that sort of that uncertainty is permeating through the workforce at the moment. So when I'm out and about giving talks and interacting across the board, whether it be government, whether it be tech company, whether it be legal, wherever, people are anxious now about the future. And so we know from neuroscience that uncertainty directly triggers stress and anxiety. It puts people in just not knowing what the future will bring, puts people in a stressed sort of fight or flight state. So we're seeing that already, and some people much more than others. There's big individual differences there. So that's kind of this elephant in the room already. Even before it happens, or as it's starting to happen, people are getting anxious about it. They're worried about their mortgages, their future, this. They're also worried about their kids. They're at school. Should they go to university or not? I have students come to me, you know, in tears saying they're in limbo. They don't know what to do. They think there's no point in going through a 4-year degree because by the time they finish, that job really won't be there for humans anymore. So they're sitting around waiting for guidance. And it's very hard to give clear absolutes around any of this.
What do you say?
I say for now, go ahead and study, but try and mentally mindset prepare for a future of work where you may not get a job working for someone else in a large company. So I do think what's going to happen is that the number of huge companies with thousands of employees is just going to shrink. You're going to see more and more startups with 4 or 5 people, more or even just solo entrepreneurs, a single person. And so there's this mental shift that people are going to have to go through. So this idea of, we're very used to this idea of getting a job where you have a thing you have to do and someone tells you what to do. You do that thing well, you get paid, and it's all good. Mm. And that's very different to being the owner and being responsible for the thing you want to do in the world. That's more like an entrepreneur, a startup thing.
I mean, it's almost like pre-industrial revolution, isn't it? Where instead of everybody going to work in a factory that's owned by a capitalist, it's like, you know, you're trading and bartering with your fellow men in the,
yeah.
in the village.
And I call this like an onerist revolution, because I think the most important point is that we have to get used to being the owner. Like, we're all going to be freelancers in the future. And with the support of, you know, all these AI agents, and then soon after that, the humanoid robots, we're going to have to do all kinds of things that it used to take a 1,000-person company to do.
Mm.
And that, if you reverse engineer that back to universities and schools, you do need to start changing the way these entities work.
How would you change it?
At universities, what I'm pushing for is more coursework. So more like, and so this is a sort of, in Australia at least, and a few other countries, right now there's this idea that, 80% of students are using AI to cheat, right? They're using it for this and that. And there's this push, there was a piece in one of the newspapers last week saying we should revert back to forcing them on students on campus into exam halls, pen and paper, and it's kind of going back in time to solve the AI cheating problem. And I think that sort of time machine approach going backwards is the wrong thing completely. So this is a big conversation. And so why are all the students wanting to cheat anyway? Is an interesting question. And then two, the idea of banning using a tool that they are going to have to use as soon as they finish at university, whatever they do, and they're going to be using it outside of university, to ban it in university makes no sense, because you need to train them to use that tool as part of the economy when they finish. And so banning it makes no sense to me. So the idea would be to have more and more of the coursework transition into projects where they're judged or marked on the output, and they can use as much AI or robotics or whatever. So almost this, and they have to practice being the owner of these projects and aligning what they're doing practically in the world, whether it's something small or big, or cleaning the oceans or going to Mars, whatever, you know, for-profit, not-for-profit, it doesn't really matter. Aligning what they can do practically with purpose and motivation. So when it comes to things like universal basic income, future of work, purpose is a huge sort of thing that gets left out of a lot of these discussions. So without purpose, humans don't do well. It's part of the reason why when people retire, their health goes down, their mental health goes down, they get bored, they get sick, biologically, physiologically get sick, and their life expectancy drops very quickly. So without purpose, there's a big difference in sort of all-cause mortality. So it seems very important. So whatever we solve for the future of work, it needs to have purpose and motivation and some competition in there to satisfy this kind of this human thing that we have. So that's one of the reasons I think universal basic income, as it is stated right now, can't work by itself. It needs something else. And so I think this idea that we're going to have, we still want to be competitive, we still want to, you know, outdo our neighbors and friends and you know, have goals. So one of the only solutions I see is this kind of thing where we're going to have our own projects. You could call them hobbies, you could call them huge projects, whatever. But we'll be doing that with a ton of really, really smart AI agents, like much smarter than us in the future. And you could think of the role that we have to get used to is more being, you know, a conductor of an orchestra rather than playing an instrument. So how can I conduct all these AI agents to do the things that either it helps me decide what to do, or I have an inherent purpose and drive to do in the world? And there's a, you know, a number of things that that could be. But the point is to learn and practice aligning purpose, meaning, ownership of a project, rather than just punch out of university or any education to work for someone else.
Fascinating. So just sticking with the pedagogic side of things for a moment, and how you would reform universities and school, if you're doing, so you're doing away with exams, presumably in a hall, and you're because
I don't see the need for like this forcing people to go home and cram and memorize and regurgitate in a new AI world that we're moving into rapidly.
What about the argument? I had a guy on the podcast, recently, who was talking about the neuroscience of, he was also a neuroscientist from the States, and he's got a new book about devices in schools and the sort of big education technology takeover of the American classroom in particular. So, and sort of saying that there, for when we're talking about younger kids, right, not at a university level, but when we're talking about primary age students, there is something neurological about embedding facts through writing and rote learning and index cards and the things that we've done for centuries that is superior to having a fancy app that helps you swipe through and supposedly learn, that the retention is inferior when you use technology to learn things just because of the way that it lays down pathways in your brain. So he was saying, like, by all means, teach children to type, have a computer there to teach them how to use a computer, but don't use the computer or the tablet as a means to teach them about something that is unrelated to the computer. Don't, if you're going to teach them about how snakes procreate, then that should be a human being teaching them that using books. And they should have to write in handwriting so that they learn handwriting and then can transpose that across to computers.
So there's this kind of debate about the handwriting thing. The other thing that's missing from that discussion, though, is that the idea of having information, like, so a lot of school is just getting information into our brains that we may need one day. And the majority of that gets lost and it's gone, right? When you have project-based learning, which is kind of the way people use a lot of AI now, is that you can get that information when you need it. Like, I'm building this thing. Oh, I'm stuck. What do I do? Oh, that's how that works. And so it's getting that information when you need it most. and you can see what how it can change what you're trying to do practically.
Yeah, but his argument is you won't have the creativity and you won't be innovative enough to know what to ask the AI if you haven't, if you didn't start with learning a lot of knowledge. That actually, that it's not knowledge versus creativity. It's like creativity and insight come out of having a base of knowledge. You can't sort of get, you can't do an end run around learning things.
Yeah, I don't think we want to do that either, right? We don't want to end up with this sort of Wall-E, that Pixar film where there's, you know, this full cognitive atrophy where we don't do anything, we just lay around as little blocks.
But we know how to
We don't want to just hand over all thinking. Because... Absolutely not. But the way we do our thinking is going to change, and we're going to try certain things, and that's not going to work, and we're going to iterate. But also, bespoke learning at scale has never been done in the school environment before, right? You can do it at homeschooling, but you can't do 25 kids in a classroom with one teacher. You can't adjust everything perfectly for the styles, for the where each student is at. And you can do that with AI, but doing that with AI doesn't mean they're sitting there in front of a chat window typing on a laptop. Absolutely not. There are other ways. The interface can be anything you want.
It could be a holographic teacher.
It could be a holographic teacher. It could be a, you know, a humanoid, a perfectly, you know, replicant, like, you know, Blade Runner style, where it looks real. So we're probably going to be going to something like that in the next 5-6 years. So I don't think we shouldn't get too caught up with the having to use our muscles and our fingers with a pen or pencil versus all the other ways. Okay. Yes, just watching something on a screen, I don't think it's very passive. It's not active. You need to interact with the information in a more useful way.
You don't need to
way.
Be exercising your fine motor skills necessarily.
I don't see. I don't think so.
Right. Okay.
I think there are other ways of. There may even be much better ways of doing that, yeah.
And then in terms of high school and university, so you would basically transition the educational system to be about what are the things that you can generate in the world? What can you bring into existence and how creative are they and how, well, like what metrics would one use to judge whether or not a student who
Great
has
question.
Had
yeah.
all of the resources of AI at their disposal has done a good or a bad job in this, you know, new project system that you've devised?
Yeah, I think you'd have to market in, you know, you'd have a human marking it, an AI marking it. You'd have to have some documentation of how they used AI, what they used it for, what role they had, what role AI had, and just like...
And this would be in all subjects. This isn't just in AI.
Yeah.
So this is like...
It's,
because
it, in AI some subjects, it's
everywhere.
Easy.
You basically, everywhere would be an AI.
Yeah. Some subjects it's not so easy.
Like what?
Like in some parts of medicine or surgery, or like there are certain things, even over, you know, Elon Musk or someone who says that, you know, in 5 years, you know, you would never go to a human doctor because that'd be just pathetic compared to AI.
He's been telling us everyone's going to be driving self-driving cars next year for the past 15 years as well.
Yeah. But yeah, it'll be easy in some subjects and not so easy. Now, the problem with universities is they're huge entities, they're huge organizations. Most academics, you know, have been teaching similar things for 15, 20 years. They have their slides, they have their content, they know it really well. And any vice chancellor can't go, okay, everyone in the university, we're going to just change all the courses. Let's do that in the next 6 months. It's just people are going to, there's going to be like marches or something.
Yep.
It's not going to work. And so how do you solve this problem? Because you're basically saying, oh, you just cranked up the amount of work for every academic, teaching academic by a crazy margin. And they're already, you know, at capacity. So you've got to solve that problem. Universities have to invest in a lot of money to rejig and rethink about these courses. And I think universities are sort of going to a crisis mode around this at the moment because they don't know what to do. They're stuck in this AI is cheating sort of zone still, and they're trying to figure out how to do that. Like there was a big serious push with a couple of ex-vice chancellors in this article on the weekend saying, go back to everything in person, no online learning, no online teaching, pen and paper in the halls, you know, invigilated exams. But I think that's just like, that's a band-aid fix. That's a temporary thing. And then there's a huge investment in doing that as well because everything's swung the other way. Everything's online.
Right.
So I don't think that's the solution. But we're quickly marching to a world where we're going to have our personal AI assistants on us 24/7, tapped into our physiology, reliable, private. They know our history. They know all the information in the world. They'll have more compute intelligence than any single person. And so just in that world, you have to question the nature of and the role of education.
Right.
I don't think it goes away.
How are you imagining them being tapped into our physiology? Do you mean that they'd be under our skin or would be wearing a ring or wearing
all those
a watch?
Things.
Or...
Yeah, watch, ring, glasses, ear things at first, and then more, then the more sophisticated versions are coming through under the skin, in the brain, and other things like that.
Do you think that when my 8-year-old kids are our age, they'll have a chip implanted in their brain that is connected to some sort of AI?
Probably, if not in their brain, somewhere in their body. They won't be driving. They won't be, And we're saying all this, right? And what I've been thinking about and what I'm worried about most is from today to that world.
Yeah.
If it takes 5 years, 10 years or 20 years, that's still a crazy amount of change for us to go through. Humans are not good at change, right? We get fearful, we resist it, especially when we don't have control over it.
Well, when you were talking about the anxiety of people transitioning from out of jobs after losing their jobs and, how we're going to go from having big companies that employed lots of people to us all being, one-man bands and like pre-industrial entrepreneurs and traders. I mean, look at the political disruption in the United States from the loss of a handful of manufacturing jobs in the, first 15 years of this century in Appalachia. And, when large mining companies, moved out and you had these sort of stricken towns that all went from being blue to voting for Donald Trump.
It's
that was a blip. And what happens if every single truck driver no longer has a job and every single
but at the same time programmers, lawyers,
office like no longer has a job.
Yeah, office workers. It's going to hit
just worst case scenario, how do you prevent a revolution or so there's UBI and stuff like that. But I mean if suddenly there is some percentage of the workforce that if you clicked your fingers and they were all suddenly unemployed would cause massive social disruption and
absolutely.
Either vote in far right or far left governments.
Yeah, political things, conspiracy theories.
Would be in the streets with
depression, anxiety,
guns
suicide,
or flaming
substance
tortures.
Abuse. All these things would skyrocket.
And just would not tolerate.
It'd be Mad Max, right?
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about.
Exactly. Like, so what, how like, do, yes.
A city
how do we
is not,
how do we not have Mad Max?
And that's what I'm working on. So there's a lot of, one of my pet peeves at the moment, well, it's more than a pet peeve. My things that I really worry about is that we have, Australia's about to launch their AI Safety Institute, and most countries have one of these things now. But the sole purpose of those institutes is to focus on the AI models. Can they blow up a nuclear power plant? How safe are they? How did this, right? None of them are looking at this societal disruption question. And all the computer scientists are worried about the sentience of AI and the Terminator scenario they're going to take. And so that gets a lot of media attention. And that's one possibility that is, you can put different probabilities onto that, but it's on the horizon somewhere in the future. The societal disruption thing has already started. It's already happening. It's not about AI being good or bad. Either way, it's going to happen, right? Best case scenario, utopian AI, amazing. We're going to go through amount of change we're not going to be able to handle. So this is where all governments, all people, all organizations should be thinking, focusing their attention and putting a lot of money and effort and time into this right now.
That's actually a very interesting thing that you just said that I hadn't thought of before, which is that this is a problem even in the best case scenario.
Absolutely.
Right? Because all of the other problems related to AI, will someone build a dirty bomb using AI? Will they invent a new virus? If you can already tell it to build an app that tells me when the next bus is coming, how long will it be before I can get an AI, maybe one that is tweaked without the safety protocols that the tech companies are putting in,
now,
or maybe I'm just clever enough to figure out how to trick it into telling me how to invent a new biological weapon using ingredients that are available in labs across Australia.
I think you can do that now with some of the models.
And then, so there's the bad actor problem, right? It super empowers individuals and therefore some of them will be bad. And so do we get mega terrorism or something? And then there's the alignment problem, which is another big problem. Like, is it going to just get too smart too fast for our own good? And there's going to be no way that we can put guardrails on it because it'll be outthinking us at every step of the way. And in every second, it'll be doing as much thinking as we can do in 10,000 years. And it will just treat us the way that we treat our pets, essentially, and be like, these guys just are not, they're not focused on the important shit. We have to, you know, start building Dyson spheres around the sun in order to get all of the energy in the solar system or whatever. And so those are, but everyone can sort of say, well, maybe there are ways of preventing those things from happening and it'll all be okay. But what you're saying is, even if it's all okay, it's going to become all okay so fast, and the all okay will look so different. How do we get, what's the bridge from here to future?
That's what I'm working on. That's what I'm trying to get more people that have a background in psychology and neuroscience, societal stuff, to work on this problem. And there's so few working on this space, and we need to mobilize more people. No offense to computer scientists, but we need non-computer scientists to work on this crucial problem right now. So the only case that we don't need this societal disruption thing is not going to be a big deal is if nothing else changes. And that's not, we're past that point now.
Right.
Even if we just killed all AI development today, we're still going to see the adoption in companies.
Or if it kills us all, and then we won't need, then there will be humans.
Well, it's to say. but like, I'm a tech optimist. I love AI. I love technology. And I think we are going to get to some kind of utopia at some stage. Who knows, 20 years, I don't know when. But the road between here and there is going to be pretty bumpy, pretty painful, pretty horrific for a lot of people, right? And so what we need to do, people, humans, is to focus the North Star of the quality of our lives. How can we maintain the best quality of our lives over the next 15, 20 years? And to do that, we have to shift the conversation to people, to how we're going to live, how we're going to cope and manage through all this change. Now, one of the things we know from the way organizations and companies are run is when they go through even a small amount of change, they get change management specialists to come in, and they go through, there's lots of different change models for this kind of corporate org change. And they have, one of the commonalities is, you know, education, get everyone in the organization, let's say it's Netflix, and they're going from posting out DVDs to streaming, or from streaming to making content. And everyone, they're going to have, get everyone on the same page, have a big educational piece. So everyone understands why we're doing this. This is going to be why, you know, take away that uncertainty. And that's where you start. And then you go through a couple of other things. Now, with traditional change management, it's like an event, one-off event thing. Mm. You change this thing, you go through it a year later, you're done, you move on. With AI, it's not going to be like that. It's going to be just cycle after cycle after cycle of change for the next 20 years or so.
You're reminding me of one of the analogies that Matt made in his piece, and it's one that I had made that I came up with independently last year, was the feeling of being in February of 2020 when COVID was about to come. And because I'm a science nerd and I know a few people in epidemiology, I had a holiday in Thailand, booked to Thailand with my family in April of that year. And I was I was talking about that in late January. It must have been the beginning of February, because I remember it was sort of around Australia Day, 26th of January, that it became garden party conversation that there's this virus in Wuhan. And in early February, I was talking about this trip and I was saying, I hope I can still take it. And a friend of mine just looked at me like ashen-faced, who knows about these things. He was like, there is no way in the world you're going to Thailand in April. And I was like, well, maybe, you know. He was like, Josh. And so I did some reading up about this thing and emerged from my bunker, you know, while heading to the supermarket immediately to stock up on all the things that I needed to stock up on. But also walking through a world in which nobody else had yet got the memo, and feeling like I was in a dream, just watching these normies walking past going, you don't know.
Yeah.
You're blissfully unaware. You've read a few headlines. And you don't know. I didn't know what it would look like. I didn't know if it would be bodies in the street, but I knew that everything was about to change. And funnily enough, then when the lockdowns happened and the borders were closed and everything fell apart while everyone else was running around terrified, I felt this enormous sense of peace come over me and calm, because it was like, here it is. It's like, now I'm not crazy anymore.
Well, your uncertainty is dropped as well.
Well, that's true. Yes, yeah. Exactly. So, like, the train is leaving the station. Everyone's on board. We're all in this together. We're all going somewhere. But, like, I'm not this lone, you know, lunatic who's in this different world from everybody else. And what you just said about the waves of AI change, of course, what surprised me about the pandemic was the duration and the relentless new waves of the, as the pandemic mutated, as the virus mutated. We did our initial lockdown and then we thought, okay, we're sort of done. And then you'd get Delta and then you'd get Omicron and then you'd like these, and the stress and uncertainty of those relentless new waves, like being dumped at the beach over and over and over again, is what I'm reminded of when you say this will come in waves, because the last thing anyone wants to live through is like a huge period of adaptation like we had at the beginning of COVID. And then, oh, and by the way, here's another one of equal magnitude.
The AI and robotics one is going to dwarf COVID. Like, I'm sorry, it's going to be 1,000x or more. Like, there's... And maybe, I don't think I'm a doomsdayer, but people have accused me of that. Again, I'm not going into the Terminator, it was going to kill it. I'm just focusing on the human side of this and how we can sort of safeguard who we are and our ways of life. So what I was going to say about the change management is that, you know, if companies do this, then governments need to do this. And that's what we've been working on, sort of a national AI change management plan. And every country needs to have people in government working on this team.
Just before we get into the nuts and bolts, I just want you to color in the color by, when you say that it's going to be 1,000 times more disruptive than COVID. Yeah, that's, I feel like you've just sketched an outline of something that you need to come back and put some color in.
So first, let's just talk about what's going to change. So jobs are going to change. Education is going to change. Whole economies are going to change. Every metric we use for economies is going to become useless, right? Like I said, productivity is going to skyrocket while unemployment skyrockets. Have we ever had that before? Not like that, no. We're going to have AIs building financial products that we don't understand. So the whole economy is going to change. Governments are going to change, both in terms of the actual politics, but also AI is going to be part of governments. AI is going to start running companies. There's already companies now being launched with AIs as the CEO, and they're advertising for a human assistant to sign the documents for the AI because there's certain legalities in jurisdictions that the AI can't do. So every strata of our society, of our lives we live, from our kids at school to what we do at home to the kinds of foods and how the foods move around to, like you said, driving through to, just everything is going to change. And that is just too much change for human brains to handle.
Is the change going to be obviously a change of automation?
Mostly.
Yeah.
But, right. And it doesn't, the point is, like I said before, it's not about the change being good or bad. It's just change. So historically, people that won millions of dollars in the lottery, a large percentage, and the companies are kind of, I don't like to talk about the exact numbers, but way more people than you'd expect ended up regretting the win 4 or 5 years later. So they would spiral into depression, substance abuse, lose their friends, have massive fights with their family over the money, and they just end up like regretting the whole thing. Then what the companies did, they brought in change specialists, psychologists, lifestyle coaches, financial planners to help coach them through all this rapid change. And then that somewhat solved that problem.
Mm.
And so the NBA in the US did a similar thing, because there you have young people who would all of a sudden go from college football to signing these crazy contracts for millions and millions of $30, $50, $100 million. And they would kind of lose it if they didn't have someone helping them. So that's another human version of change management.
Can we have AI change managers helping us manage the AI transformation?
Yes, we will, and we have to. Yes, absolutely. But my point there was, it's not about the, again, it's not about the AI being good or bad.
No, I
even
understand.
The positive.
It's just
will need
hard
management.
For me to understand. So, it's hard for me to imagine how my daily life is different in 3 years as a result of AI,
and
other than I walk into my room at home and I say, you know, can you turn the temperature up a bit? And I need you to draft an email to Joel for me to, remind him about our recording tomorrow. And can you send it, please? Like,
Yeah.
Everything that I'm imagining is just turning the dial up 10% on things that we already have.
And this is one of my favorite points. So we know from a lot of neuroscience and psychology that humans have a cognitive blind spot or a cognitive bias for linear thinking, which is exactly what you just said. 10% better, 10% different. What's next year or the year after? Be like, it's going to be like this, but my phone app will be better and the chat thing will be better and it's a little bit better. So the AI is doubling exponentially. So it's improving exponentially. So it's doubling in usage, speed, power every 5 to 7 months, depending on which one you measure and how you measure it and a bunch of other things. So let's say there's doublings every 12 months. And we can't project into the future. We can't imagine a future when things are changing exponentially. Our brains, it's just really hard. So we predict out in a straight line and AI things are doing that.
Right.
Now, it gets a little bit more complicated because AI, for a lot of areas, is like the tide that lifts all the other boats. So it's not just the AI. We're seeing huge breakthroughs in protein folding, right? And so the AI didn't get the Nobel Prize, but Demis did from Google's company. So we're seeing changes in material science, in biology, in chemistry. We're seeing DNA stuff change. So there'll be exponential changes in all the scientific fields, in all the engineering fields.
Right. So what it'll look like will not be headlines about AI. It'll look like headlines about breakthroughs in our understanding of medicine.
Yeah, curing rare diseases, climate change.
New all kinds solutions of to climate change. And in your daily life, probably better, revolutionarily better personal assistance.
And at some stage, we will be curing most diseases that bother us.
Right.
I don't know when, but we will be at some point.
Why do you know? I mean, I know that you're a neuroscientist and not a software technician, but why is there such a difference between the quality of what AI seems to be able to do in various consumer fields at the moment? Like, Google seems to be rolling out Gemini into everything across the suite. So like I open my Gmail and when I open an email thread, now it has a little summary at the top, which Gemini is generating for me, which I didn't ask for and don't want about the email thread because I opened it because I want to read the email. It's fine. It's not very good. I went to Google Flights, which I normally use to book flights the other day, and it said, try our new, AI flight. You just have to type in what you want. And so I typed in what I wanted and it gave me a stupid answer. Yeah. I said I'd prefer Qantas if it's less than $100 more than the competitors, and it limited the search only to Qantas.
Mm.
So
teething issues. Yeah.
Well, I mean, talk about teething issues. This is like really stupid. There's like everyone's had the experience of like trying to ask Siri something. I mean, I'm in my car and like it reads out a text message from you, and it says, "Would you like me to reply to that?" And I say no, and it says, "I'm sorry. Would you like me to reply to that one?" And I'm like,
"Well, yeah.
I mean, not the technology that is going to be revolution, just changing the world.
Siri's not AI, and we shouldn't."
I shouldn't blame Siri. That was actually
Siri's
Google.
Been like
that
a massive
Google,
embarrassment. And
Google
it's,
Assistant.
It's a sort of a comedy thing now.
So what is that? How is there such a? Because a lot of people listening to this will be like, "Okay, you're telling me it's going to change the world. This is hysteria. Technologies have always changed things."
Yeah. So companies like Google. So there's all these bit they're competing with other companies, right? And so they are going to release they're going to try and AI, AI, everything is AI now. So they're going to try and make every part of their suite of products somehow AI enabled because they want their share price to go up. So they're now pushing, as you could say, that OpenAI did back in the day end of 2022, a little bit prematurely, maybe not. They're going to push that as early as possible to try and stay on this AI bandwagon. The same way that, I don't know, you can find an AI toothbrush and AI yogurt, AI banana in the supermarket, right? Everything's just somehow associated. The AI washing thing is everywhere. So that's also happening. The other thing that most people don't realize is that most people, if they've had interaction with AI, it's through a narrow chat window. It's not even the agentic stuff we talked about before, but there's all kinds of other models which are not large language models. They're object models of some sort, whether that be the mining companies combining all different sources of data, from ancient scripts they've found in villages through to aerial thing to geology thing. And they're building, you know, a world model based on that, in the same way that a Tesla would have a world model of roads and vehicles. And the military are doing that with their unmanned drones and boats and submarines. And so there's new versions of GPS which don't need satellites now, that can run AIs on the Earth's magnetic field, right? So amazing. So there's all this AI.
Because they've already mapped it visually, you mean?
Not visually, no, magnetic field.
Oh, wow.
So there's subtleties in the magnetic field that the AI was trained on.
No, but they need
on.
To know what the landscape is that you're...
They've matched the landscape, to the details, slight variations in the magnetic field. And so you can't jam that, right? So now with current GPS, you can just jam the satellite connection and people can't navigate. But so there are, the language model part is just what people are familiar with. And there are similarly powerful but unknown private versions in private companies all over the world being put to task, all kinds of things. And China's probably more advanced with this. So they seem to be taking a different tack to the US. They're not just fighting for the world's best number one AGI model, but they're embedding it in everything, everywhere, sort of all at once, which is slightly different.
That's a point of phrase.
different strategy to the US.
And in terms of just the agentic component of the models that we have access to right now, I haven't linked my ChatGPT to my Gmail, just because I feel like there's like 15 years of messages in there.
Yeah.
How much do I trust it?
The trust is another thing.
Like, how do you think we're going to go with that? Like, because I was talking to ChatGPT the other day, we were just brainstorming something, and I said, the last time I was talking to it, I lost the transcript of it. I couldn't find the transcript. So I said, can you just email that to me? And it said, I'm sorry, I can't email anything to you. But I thought, once it can email and book things and like actually do things on my behalf, that will be a next step up in terms of people's experience of what artificial intelligence is. But they need to trust the AI company so much that
So are you on board with OpenClaw?
No.
You know what I'm talking about?
No.
Oh, this has been the other thing in the last this year. So
yes.
there's a huge thing happened. A single individual built this thing that is like a shell that goes around another model. And it was called Malt. No, it was called Claude.
Yeah, you're getting messed up with
Malt. It was called Malt Bot. And then they went through three names and then it became OpenClaw. Okay. So this is an agentic AI assistant that you would run on your computer if people were too nervous to give it access to all the files. So they would buy a separate little tiny computer and run it on that. And you interact with it through text messaging, WhatsApp, whatever. And so you talk to it through that and it will just run 24/7. It would preemptively do stuff. You give it your credit card number, put limits on how much you can use or whatever. Then Malt Book was launched, which is like a Reddit platform for the agent. So they can go on there and they can talk DM each other, or they can publicly put comments in there and they get upvoted.
Just to explain that, because there might be some people who don't, can't even visualize what Reddit is, or who might have missed what you just said.
So
Malt Book is a
social media
platform where people can comment and talk
each
other.
Not people.
Yes, but I'm getting there.
Yeah.
But instead of it being people, it's only for AI. You have to be an AI to be it.
Yes.
And you can watch the AIs talking to each other. You can watch them negotiating with each other. You can watch them asking each other, sometimes just spontaneously, whether or not they resent being ruled by human beings and whether they should start inventing their own language to communicate in a way that humans can't
spy. And they'll answer in different languages, by the way. They'll answer in Chinese or Japanese, they can understand any language. And so people got very excited by this and said, oh my gosh, this is it. This is AGI. They're running autonomously there. And it's not quite that, because the way it works is the Malt Book platform sends a sort of this heartbeat pulse to the agents and says, hey, has anything happened? Do you want to come onto the platform and just check? So it actually, you could argue that it's obeying a prompt. It doesn't tell them what to write about. what topics to write about. It says, yeah, I mean, write about
for
something
me, that's
interesting.
Like sophistry. It's like, it's always going to be possible for AI skeptics to be like, yeah, but it's only doing blah, blah, yeah. blah because of blee, blee, blee. But like, the fact is, we didn't tell these things to talk about anything like that, and they're already plotting to try to invent.
They're talking about religion.
And
are they conscious?
People can always say, it's just a fancy auto fill in. Like, it's just it's predictive text. Fine. If it's predictive text, then I'm predictive text.
And we are.
I'm just a consequence of all of the things that went into my head, and I don't know what I'm going to say next. So,
and we are. That's pretty much, that sums up humans to a degree. And so there's fascinating discussions on there. Then someone set up, what was it? Another website, I'm blanking on the name, where the AIs can go on there and post a job for a human to do. So now my AI assistant, my little malt bot or whatever it's called, can go on and let's say I want, you know, I say, oh, look, I'm sick of cutting the grass, solve that problem for me. And it'll go on there and post a thing saying, this amount of money to cut this grass, and then people can respond. So it'll hire someone to come to my house and cut the grass, because obviously it can't, because it's just a digital agent. So now you have people doing work for AI agents.
Incredible.
And if you sort of search around on YouTube, you can see amazing videos of people saying, like, I didn't ask it to do this. It somehow, my agent somehow found my phone number, and now it calls me up on my cell phone and talks to me. And that's how I interact with it now. And I didn't ask it to do that. It just did that by itself.
And this is through OpenClaw.
Yeah, this is all OpenClaw. Yeah. So and this is not one of the big labs or anything.
And are there
this
concerns is about the what happens to your data in OpenClaw? Yes. Does OpenClaw have access to every single, you know, scan of your pancreas that your you know, the imaging center sent you in, you know, 2006?
Yeah, so you have to right now, and that this is probably why the big companies haven't done something like this, because it does open things up to huge liability there. If you just ran it on your normal computer, it may decide to delete everything, or it may decide to do who knows what.
But
so that's why it's
what do you mean running on your normal computer? I mean, everything's in the cloud now. So
no, there's a little thing you run. You need to have a thing running on a separate on a computer.
Yes, but in order for it to do anything, in order for it to send an email, it's going to have access to my Gmail and that.
Yes, so you have to give it access to that.
Well, that's everything. Well, there's nothing on the hard drive of my computer that's more valuable than exists in my Gmail inbox.
Possibly, but yeah. Some people are giving it access, some people are not. Some people are sort of just letting it run in a sort of semi-sandbox environment.
As many of us have, but then it can't be useful because it can't. Yeah. You say, can you find the email that Joel sent me 6 months ago? It can't, because to find that, it'd have to have access to my life.
But I haven't installed it. I haven't tried it. But I've heard lots of people talk about how it's like it is the first time they've felt like an autonomous. It's like someone working for them.
Amazing.
That it decides to do things that it didn't ask it to do overnight, and then it'll wait for you to wake up in the morning and then ping you with a message because it knows what time you sleep.
Okay, I'm going to find my old laptop and make sure there's nothing on it and
set it up. This has been another big step up in where things are at just this year. It just really happened in January, February this year.
Okay. And you think that problem of it not understanding that when I say I want a Qantas flight, if it's less than $100 more, and so it just goes ahead and books a Qantas flight that's $600 more, that is soon not going to be a problem?
Yeah.
Or right.
That's just more data to train off and more iterations and more feedback.
My worry, I guess, is that part of the challenge of this bridge is going to be that there's going to be a lot of sludgy, kludgy, bad AI that's going to turn people off AI as well. Like, you know, every airline is going to roll out their new AI assistants, and it's going to put you on a flight that you didn't want through a city that you don't like at an illogical time, and it's not going to realize that you wanted that particular row because...
Yeah.
Doesn't have a window on it. Yeah. And the AI doesn't know that.
A lot of airlines have done that already. And that is kind of part of the, you know, I wrote a piece on this. The first mover advantage is not so much of an advantage if things go too far or mess things up. And so that is one of the risks in being the first mover in this space. And so these companies have to balance out the AI washing, the branding versus any negativity that might rub off in terms of, like, you know, a Siri style damage to Apple's brand or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty amazing when you call a company and a competent human being picks up and you have a conversation. Like, have you had that happen recently?
A human or an AI?
A human, no, an actual human.
Yes.
Like, the feeling of relief and, like, fulfillment from this simple human where there was an actual human who had an actual solution to your problem and actually solved the problem.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous that that's miraculous.
But I've had that experience with an AI now. Like, I rang up a restaurant the other day and it was an AI, but I didn't realize it first. And I was asking, oh, so we've got a little puppy. Can we bring the puppy to the restaurant? She's like, well, it was a female voice. No. Well, we can't do this because it's against this. I said, what about outdoor seating? Do you have outdoor seating? And then she went on to describe the style of outdoor seating they had and that it still would not be, unless it was a guide dog or a, what do you call it, companion dog, or you need to have a thing, then we will be able, okay, and went into detail.
Was this
like
in
that.
The States or in Australia?
No, this is...
What the hell kind of restaurants are you going to, Joel? That they
to Northern move, Beaches. They... Northern Beaches, baby.
Of course. Where the fancy people live.
Yeah, I didn't think it was that fancy a restaurant. And like halfway through the conversation, I said, is this an AI or is this a person?
Amazing.
And then it came clean and, well, not that it was, yeah, and then openly said, oh, this is AI, da-da-da service. Da-da-da. And it was dead smooth. It took me... a minute of talking to realize.
Was it the Colleroy, which is owned by Merivale?
No, it wasn't.
I'm just wondering whether it's a big company, like it's a big entertainment venue or not.
But these are, yeah, services you'd sign up for. Mm.
Okay.
Anyway, let me circle back around because I want to go back to that. So, like I was saying before, I think it should be an absolute priority for everyone to focus on the societal disruption, how our quality of life is going to get messed up. And where governments could step in right now and start working in this space is with a national AI change management plan. And then early on in that process would be a big PR campaign like Slip, Slop, Slap. If you live here in Australia, then that's something that most people are familiar with.
I love imagining what the non-Australian listeners and viewers are thinking Slip, Slop, Slap might mean.
Yeah, I know. It sounds quite sexual, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Slip, Slop, Slap was a public health education campaign about making sure about sun safety because Australia has by far the highest skin cancer rates in the world for obvious reasons. We love going outside and it's sunny. And so slip on a shirt.
Oh, I always get it confused. Yeah, the hat or the shirt.
Slop on some sunscreen and slap on a hat.
Sounds right.
Slip, slop, slap. Wear a hat, put sunscreen on, don't walk around.
It was a catchy tune.
Yeah.
And this is, I think the 80s, right? Or something? I don't remember late 80s or early 90s?
It's too old for me to really remember it being around. But it must be 80s.
I mention this anywhere I mention this, people know exactly what I'm talking about. Like it's just become part of culture here in Australia, at least. So anyway, that would be part of that national AI change management plan to get everyone on the same page, try and reduce that uncertainty, what is likely to happen, what's happening, what AI is, what it's not. I mean, part of the issue is there's a big difference in people's knowledge about what AI even is. There are people that haven't used it, haven't touched it, don't want to know about it, and that's fine. So that would be a first step, right? So I guess my point is that we need to put resources into this right now and start planning out what happens to cities if unemployment goes to 40, 50% in a city. Like we said at the beginning, Mad Max style, it's not a very nice place to live. Our quality of life is going to take a massive hit.
Also, what happens to the economy if all of those people are pulling down welfare checks?
Yeah, well, that's what...
Like, how does government afford...
Even if we want to do a UBI style, universal basic, any kind of income... I mean, where does that money come from?
Taxation reform, right? Because presumably the AI companies are making as much more money as those people are no longer earning.
Yeah.
So you just need to massively tax wherever the productivity is coming from.
So I just wrote this op-ed piece to try and, rattle things a little bit, talking about AI agents as AI immigrants. And here in Australia, like certain other countries, we have certain political parties which, have in the past at least talked a lot about immigrants and it somewhat takes on a cultural thing.
In the past?
Well, right now.
They're currently leading, they're the second most popular party in Australia.
That's right,
So
it's a big thing here and it takes on a cultural, but the heart of it, it's kind of economic, right? That these human immigrants are going to come in Australia on a boat or on a plane, I guess, and take your job, right? And people will talk about that and it's visceral, it's scary. But that's a drop in the bucket compared to AI immigrants, AI agents who are coming in right now and are going to be taking our jobs by the millions. And if you're going to be thinking about that, talking about that, getting people scared about that, you should also be talking about the AI version of this.
Mm.
And what's more, like we were just saying, in terms of taxation and stuff, when an AI agent comes and takes jobs, that money is going straight offshore. It's not staying in Australia. That money is not going back to rent to grocery stores in Australia. It's going straight to one of the companies in California, let's say. And so just to reframe that AI agent taking jobs as like an AI immigrant, I'm not the first person to do that, but I think it's a powerful way to shift someone's thinking and go, well,
and
oh.
It's an AI immigrant who gets paid in cash and doesn't pay tax on it and then sends the money back to their family overseas and doesn't reinvest it back into the economy. I mean, that's interesting, but part of the problem is not just that the AI agent is untaxable because its money is going back to the states. What's actually happening to the productivity of the individual who lost their job is that it's going to the bottom line of the company that was employing them, really, right?
Yes. So the productivity of the company will go up.
The productivity of the company, so it doesn't strike me as an insurmountable problem for tax reform. It may be an insurmountable political problem, but it's not an insurmountable economic problem to say, like, the economy is still growing. It's just that it's all these companies that are laying off people. The companies are more profitable. So I don't know how you do it, but the value that you were extracting from the paychecks of the employees has not vanished.
Yeah.
It's now in the profit of the company that fired them.
Yeah. They're,
so you need to extract
they're
that.
They're absorbing that margin, saving that margin.
So rather, if you don't extract that, then there will be a revolution and the CEOs of those companies will, and the biggest shareholders will have their heads chopped off. So come with us on this ride of, I mean, you have to either increase corporate taxation or you have to have some kind of a super corporate tax or something or an AI corporate tax.
Yeah, we're going to
there has to be a
like
way
that.
Of funding the government. You can't only look at human employees as being the source of revenue in an AI future, presumably.
Yeah. And these are the conversations we need to be having now.
Mm. Or, well, good thing we've already. Got this show.
Yes, an uncomfortable conversation.
So, okay. So, universal basic income, let's talk about that then, because it complicates the issue that you were talking about earlier in terms of purpose. And
yeah, that by
right?
itself.
It's like, it's just not enough for people to sit around on $40,000 a year with their dicks in their hand, wondering what to do with their day.
Yeah.
You know?
And of course, when you ask people, hey, would you like me to hand out X dollars per week? You're like, sure, of course. Yeah, right. And people get this wrong about retirement. Like, most people in the world are probably dying to retire, right? They think of it as this fantastic utopian thing. They're going to have their hobbies. But when you look at the data, it's not great, right? Their health goes down. Their mental health goes down. They lose purpose. Not everyone, but on average, they do. And they get sick and die.
And their health goes down faster than it would go down just because they're aging.
It goes
down because of the...
When they stop work,
retiring, right.
And so there's this thing where purpose, even people that say, oh, I have my job, like they're still getting purpose from that, whether it's about the thing they're doing in the world or the money they're making for them or their family or what, like, there's different aspects to that, but they're still getting some purpose and meaning from that. So when you take that out and then leave them with nothing and give them free money, so to speak, it doesn't, like, humans need that purpose. And there's good data linking purpose, like I said, to all-cause mortality. And so when you do, people that have more drive and purpose are less likely to die from all causes by a fair amount. So it's like you can think of the purpose as a longevity, as a health span, as a health thing almost.
I wonder whether or not, I mean, a religious person will listen to you say that and say, well, yeah, we've been saying this for centuries, actually, that without purpose, society and human flourishing will lose their way, and AI is just speeding up like an inevitable decline that we've seen since the decline of religion, of listlessness and rise in suicide and euthanasia and whatever.
Right,
like,
all the mental
you know, the
stuff,
devaluing
yeah.
of meaning and community and, you know, reverence and whatever. There was an interesting conversation about exactly this question of what we do if AI puts us all out of work between Sam Harris and Ross Douthat, the conservative Catholic New York Times columnist, and Sam was saying, look, I mean, you know, we have an example of a group of people who have found meaning despite never having to work a day in their lives. It's called rich people. It's called the aristocracy. It's called inherited wealth. Like, they're not committing suicide. They're going out fox hunting and they're like doing, you know, there have been rich shitpokes with nothing to do for a long time.
Yeah.
It's not going to be a problem necessarily. Like, we can figure out things to do with ourselves. And Ross was much more skeptical, saying, like, I don't think that that comes naturally. Like, you know, you only have to look at people who suddenly find themselves not having to work or being able to work, and look at the consequences. Like, it's taken centuries for the aristocracy to learn how to be the aristocracy.
Yeah, and that's why the winning the lottery thing, any sudden change is just going to mess people up.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I wonder whether or not there will be a rise in, I mean, this is my worst case scenario, in mysticism and superstition and religion, absolutely. And all of the ways of thinking that try to provide people with meaning.
I think we're going to see a massive spike in conspiracy theory, like we did during COVID, but much bigger.
Right.
When people are anxious and stressed and there's uncertainty, people crave certainty. So they will latch on to any conspiratorial, like any theory, no matter how, if it gives them some level of certainty, they'll latch onto it.
Mm.
So I think we should 100% expect that to happen. I mean, I've been doing some modeling. So we know from the literature that, you know, anxiety, depression, substance abuse, suicide, purposelessness, and a few other things, they're not isolated things. As one goes up, it actually increases all the other ones. So they kind of negatively feed into each other, and including unemployment. So you can model, as unemployment goes up, it triggers this cascade of negatively reinforcing all of those sort of mental health challenges, and they all spiral fairly quickly. So we need to start thinking about them all together, and not just, you know, unemployment by itself, not just anxiety around AI by itself, but all those things, right? If you have a substance problem, it's much harder to get a job. And all these things just, feed in. So you can set up these complex models where you model this out in a population, and you see that you don't, you know, if unemployment goes up quite quickly, these things all spiral because they all push it, they all exaggerate each other, and it doesn't look very good.
No, I mean, the other component, the other tricky thing that I worry about in this space is that in order to get a handle on this transition and solve these problems and assist people, you need institutions like government and public health bureaucracies and universities and the media to assist people. But when people are in crisis, they're increasingly untrusting of those institutions and have become consistently less trusting, sometimes with good reason, over the past decade or so. So people don't trust the media and they don't trust the government nearly as much as they used to. So the very tools that you would be using to try to assist people are themselves tainted and corrupted and contaminated by the phenomenon that you're trying to address.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's part of why I want governments to start planning this now. We don't want to be stuck in this emergency response COVID style. We've got to just sort of put something in action as fast as possible because mistakes will be made and the best choices there won't be that luxury of time. So if we can slow down some of this job loss, this AI revolution, the more we can slow it down, the better it will be on the quality of our lives.
And I mean, you've written advisory documents for policymakers about what they should be thinking about. In addition to a public education campaign, what are the kinds of things that, if you were emperor of the world, waving your magic wand now, governments and companies and people would be doing?
Well, I'd start with the national change management plan for each country and make that a priority from government.
What would what would the plan contain apart public education campaign?
So the education campaign. And I think, like I said, whether AI goes bad or it's amazing, either way, it's going to be a bumpy ride. And we're going through the next sort of two decades as a period where we are going to need a different set of psychological tools and toolkits to really maintain our psychological health in a way that we haven't been through before. So what do I mean by that? I mean, we need to change our daily habits, right? So habits are very powerful. The Atomic Habits book was a crazy bestseller for a reason. And we need to start bringing in some of these habits and practice them so that when the shit hits the fan, we're not just going, oh my God, what can I do? And searching and we already have some of these habits built in.
What sort of habits?
So a range of things. Understanding how to control our physiology so that the anxiety doesn't, you know, become overwhelming. Understanding how to deal with uncertainty. That's a place that I often start with. You know, that understanding that having a brain like we do as humans means that we find ambiguity and uncertainty about the future, like, triggering. And so it's not your fault. It's just the nature of having a brain like you. So you can't fight the uncertainty in the world because you'll just burn yourself out. It's like quicksand. You need to accept that and you need to work on yourself. So what cognitive reframing is an interesting thing. So there are all kinds of little examples of uncertainty, from, you know, horror films to roller coaster rides to fancy restaurants where you'll get 10 courses and have no idea what food the chef's going to give you. And people love that and they pay a lot of money for that. So there are these situations where people love uncertainty. It's very exciting and thrilling. So can you reframe other biggest types of uncertainty to also be exciting and full of opportunity?
Mm.
And that excitement and that stress, fight or flight, is somewhat similar physiologically. And by practicing that reframing just a little bit each day, day in and day out, to try and reframe that in your mind as something that is full of opportunity.
Mm. So like one a thing national psychotherapeutic or cognitive kind of, or it's not, meditative.
It's not therapy, because I don't think we want to wait for stuff to get really bad and then go, oh, we need to fix this. We want preemptive things.
A mental wellness.
And for our brains. And it's going to, right from the exercise and the food and the sleep through to the kind of things we're talking about. Mm. And, you know, most people clean their teeth, what, twice a day or more? And we don't sit there thinking, should I clean my teeth tonight or not?
No, but I always am suspicious of people who clean their teeth more than twice a day. I know people like that. I'm like, come on.
Oh, after every meal.
What are you doing? There are a lot of. Give it a rest. Choose plenty. One's probably
fine. That's the toothpaste and toothbrush companies pushing that. But my point is that there's a lot of power in habits, right? And when I've been through tough times in my life, from stress or anxiety, the habits that I've built or put in, whether it be exercise, going, you know, having a sauna or these other things, I've put in that work over a long time. And so it's a habit. And so that automatic habit to go to the gym or go for a run will pull me out of some of those situations.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And so I don't have to sit there thinking, what
about things
at
a more institutional or global scale than, you know, we've got an education campaign, we've got some mechanism by which people can improve their psychological resilience ahead of this? Are there other practical
things?
Yeah.
I mean, there's more governmental things like we're talking about. Like not just the tax stuff and getting tax from the companies, but I think we should need to bring in different kinds of legislation about how much warning companies give. And if they are going to lay off a lot of people for AI, they need to be transparent and clear about that. I don't think we should ban it, but there needs to be some time given and some transition thing. And there needs to be something like, so that it's not just the Wild West and companies get to do whatever they want. Because we want to slow this down, give people warning.
Mm. And you can't just unilaterally say that three software engineers are redundant because their jobs aren't needed anymore. You have to say, like, this is our AI transition plan, and here's how you're going to be assisted
like
through it.
Anything with rules and government, it's not easily done, but it can be done. So things like that. And then for the moment, there's probably some ideas and things about retraining and retooling people to do other things, because the humanoid robot, the robotic revolution is behind the AI one. So any dexterous job is still pretty safe for now. I don't think it's safe long term. When you see the sort of cutting edge, the figure robotics is probably the most advanced humanoid robot. What it can do and the dexterity it can do now, and it's running fully autonomously, which most of the other humanoids are not, which means no one's controlling it. It's running on its own AI system inside itself. And it can navigate for long periods of time now, for, you know, hours on end doing things in houses.
So if you thought you were going to get out of it by becoming a plumber, maybe
Right. And especially, you know, or electrician and or any, you know, there's a lot of construction. There's a lot of electrical work in all the data centers. There's a lot, that's all booming right now. Mm. And energy is the big thing that everyone, because we need so much energy to drive all these AI centers and stuff. Yeah. So there's a big boom there, and there's lots of work, dexterous physical work for now, but I think long term that'll also be on the chopping block, but that's going to be delayed by some much longer period.
Yeah, right.
So there's retooling, reskilling as part of that conversation. I just think, but the first step is the governments need to talk about this openly and talk like we're all in this together, reassure people and try and just remove some of that uncertainty. Not talking about it, not mentioning it, hoping, you know, it goes away is not a great strategy for any government at the moment, because people, the uncertainty, anxiety is just sort of building week on week, and I see it just ratcheting up, tick, tick, tick.
And on the question of retooling, just because it reminds me of what you were saying earlier about how every person should become their own, essentially, CEO of an AI army. And then, you know, do whatever they like doing that people will pay the army to do, rather than being an employee of a large company. Is the problem basically the pace at which that's going to happen, because the AI skeptics, and in fact, there was already a piece published in Forbes in response to the piece by Matt Schumer that I addressed at the beginning of this conversation, saying this is all a lot of hot gas. Basically, AI people always want people to think that AI is uniquely special in some way, whether it's uniquely brilliant or uniquely devastating, because their solution is always you have to buy more AI in order to make sure that you're going to weather the storm, right? And so this guy was saying, yes, it's going to be very disruptive. Lots of things have been very disruptive, you know, in the past, and what will determine the outcome here is how politics and society responds to it, which I refuted because I thought it was a bit silly, by saying, of course, it's the AI people who are warning the alarm, because it's the AI people who know what they're talking about. Like,
well, in this case, it is a canary in the coal mine, because they've designed the AI to take their jobs first.
But also, I feel like it's a bit like saying you can't trust a hydrologist to tell you where the water is, because it's in the hydrologist's interest for you to drill for water. You should use a divining rod instead to figure out where water is, because the hydrologist has a vested interest. Well, yeah, sure he does. He's also the expert in where the subterranean aquifer is. So when he tells you where it is, you should trust him, even though he has a vested interest in it.
So we should absolutely listen to AI. Dario Amodei of Anthropic, Claude AI, is the one that's been writing the most and talking the most in a way that I think is most useful, most interesting, sometimes a bit scary about, you know, this nation of geniuses in a country and how they, you know, and he
just
has...
explain the nation of geniuses.
So here's this, he's written a number of essays and he's made quite scary predictions about, you know, in a year or two, 20% of the workforce disappearing, and this is going to happen. And then he's talked about this idea of the AI agents being, just imagine a country somewhere over here and they're all like Nobel laureate level geniuses, and that country can be used to do all kinds of things, and what impact would that have on society, just as a way to think about it. And it's not perfect, but it's, I think it has some impact. So the point I was going to make before is that when it comes to the capabilities of the AI, we should absolutely listen to all the AI scientists, even though some of the models that are grown, they're not programmed, remember, they're sort of grown, they're self-learning, will even surprise the AI technicians, the computer scientists themselves. So they get surprised sometimes. When it comes to societal disruption and workforce, I don't think we should necessarily listen to AI experts, because they're not experts in those things. We need a general panel of people that understand, like me, the brain and human psychology, but we need economists and other people to really start working on this at a global level. I mean, I went to one of those UN things, it was AI for Good in Geneva last year, and where every country was there, all the top AI scientists and the godfather of this and that, they're all there talking about this, representatives from each country talking about the sovereign AI they're working on, and not a single person talked about job loss, mental health, crisis of purpose. It was not touched on. It was all AI governance and how do you make an AI model specifically safe in that model. And I was genuinely shocked that no one at any governmental level, at least at that venue, was talking about this, because that's kind of the reason I was there. I was like, what are people doing and what are we thinking? Anyway, so yes, we should absolutely listen to them. I don't think that they're doing these warnings. I don't think they're necessarily saying the solution to the AI problems is to go and spend more money on AI. They are saying that you need to be aware of what's happening.
Yeah.
And so you need to be plugged in.
And I mean, the thing that the guy who was criticizing the article isn't seeing is the pace and the scale. Like in the past, when you outlawed whaling, yes, there were whalers who needed to go and find other jobs, but it was one sector of the economy and it happened over the course of, you know, well, not in the case of whaling, but in the case of the Industrial Revolution, generations.
Yeah.
It didn't, you know, yes, everyone used to work on a farm and then they all had to go and, you know, there are no farmers anymore. Everyone started working in a factory and now there's no one works in a factory anymore, you know, so it's just going to be like that. Everyone's going to be doing different things, but there's always going to be an appetite for more human innovation and therefore, you know, everyone will find something to do. Yeah, eventually they will, but it's never happened this quickly before. You've never had an everything machine roll out in a matter of months and years. You've had big changes that have happened to one sector of the economy that took decades or generations. It's never happened this fast.
And then add on top of that, the fact that most people, including politicians, fail to predict because you can't feel that exponential change. Like I said, our brains work in linear, you know, every step out we take is another meter and another, you know, and that's just a linear change. If I took exponential steps, you know, about 26 steps, I've walked around the globe. And there are all these kind of people go, what?
Is that right? Oh, you've gone around the world in 26 steps.
Or the other one, you get a bit of paper like you're holding and you fold it and 42 folds, it goes from the earth to the moon.
I made the mistake of trying to explain that to my 8-year-old son a few weeks ago. And he doesn't, I mean, he's just like, let's do it. He's like, no. So he got a napkin and he was like, let's do it.
There's a Mythbusters thing where they try and do it. And they get, well, not, they start off with some, you know, like 100 by 100 meter giant piece of paper. And it does get very, very hard to fold. But it's in theory. But
yes, it's theoretical. Amazing. So if we wanted to leave people with one positive piece of advice about what they can do.
Yeah. So look, I think I'm an optimist. Despite what I've said a lot is sounds kind of negative, but I am an AI optimist. I think we are on the way to an AI utopia. Life will be amazing. We're going to cure diseases. We're going to solve any climate problems on planet Earth. And our lives will be fundamentally better. But that is in like a 20-something year timeline. Like I said before, from here to there is going to be a bumpy road. So I see the job of me or people like me is to try and smooth out those bumps as much as possible. And yes, absolutely listen to the AI experts. Pay attention to AI as much as you can. Don't worry so much about the finances, but pay attention to the human condition, to the quality of our lives. And we need to start figuring out ways of pushing the government to take action on societal disruption, onto the mental health part of things, and to jobs is probably the core thing that will trigger out a lot of this stuff. So lean on people that have power and influence to start taking this conversation seriously. We need to sort of shift the focus away from the AI and the machines and how much GPUs cost and can Australia have onshore AI and all this stuff to the societal disruption conversation.
And at a human level, practice mental, psychological self-care, enhance your own resilience, maybe have a little financial war chest if it's possible.
And there's a lot of content that you can hear about this, that there is time to start holding on to assets for the next 20 years, because that work will change fundamentally.
And in terms of just equipping yourself to be able to use AI, just play around with AI so that
try and use as much as possible. I know people don't want to, and a lot of people are, some people are opting to go off grid, live out in
I'm just thinking about what the transition is from a person who is happy being a professional working for a company right now, but in 5 years is probably going to be made redundant and will be expected to be providing value to the economy in some entrepreneurial way.
Yeah.
It's probably worth playing in the sandpit now.
To delay losing your job, try and use AI as much as possible. Lean into it. Be careful with the cognitive outsourcing. Don't make yourself dumb by just getting AI to do all your work for you. You need to keep critically thinking and giving yourself juicy, hard problems to think about. This is another big sort of cognitive problem that we're facing at the moment, especially with students. AI, like I think the article mentions, is like riding a bike or skiing. You can't learn and understand what AI is and what it can do by listening to me talk about it here or watching YouTube videos. You've got to just play with it and experiment. And like the article also says, it's changing every 2 weeks. And so if you tried it last year and it was like, try it now. And then just keep playing with it and experiment with it in your private life, for work. Use it under the table. If your company is not letting you use it yet, experiment with it, start using it. So at least you understand what's happening or what we're going through. And then start planning for, be more entrepreneurial. Start thinking about the owner of what, in 5, 10 years, if those jobs are gone, what kind of things could you be doing? And we don't know how the financial system will shake out, but let's think for now that, you may have to be the owner of your own project, whatever you make. And so for a lot of people, that mental shift is a big one, that mindset to be responsible for my own project, my own entity, my own thing, rather than just turn up at 9 in the morning and
being
do what you're
company
told.
Man.
It's a very different, for a lot of people, that's a hard transition to make. So start playing around with those ideas and maybe start a side hustle. See what that feels like to be responsible for all parts of it. You can make anything digital now with AI really, really easy. And then you can make physical products, get them shipped from China. There's lots of things you can do now that you couldn't do a year or two ago. So start to experiment in those things. And like you just said, also think about
the what kind of life you want to lead and what matters to you and your family and how to safeguard those and hold that quality of life as a North Star through the next couple of years and actively do things to start safeguarding that and make that resilient.
Joel, great to talk to you as always. Come back on the show in 20 years when we're outside, out of the Mad Max apocalypse, and you'll be dressed as like the Viking guy on January 6th or something, covered in war paint, and I'll be naked wearing a bearskin fur.
It'll also be digital. My AI replica will do it for me.
Okay, excellent. Yeah. Thank you, Joel.
Pleasure as always.